Hi everyone, it is time for part two of the Hit Parade of 1977, the Rhode Island edition.
Hey, I'm kind of becoming partial to Rhode Island.
I don't want to get a message from you someday that you have decided to relocate there.
Hey, no worries about that. If I ever leave my West Coast world, it'll be for Sicily only, the hot climes of Sicily.
Hey, listen, Lila and I will have a place to visit at least.
Okay, well, enough of that. We can't make this another long one, and since we don't have a question this week, let's just dive right in.
All right. The first homicide we are discussing today is that of Mike Ross, an old-time fence and one of the box holders at the bonded vault at the time of the heist. Mike was gunned down on March 28th by a man wielding a .22 caliber Winchester rifle. His bullet-ridden body was found in a Lazy Boy furniture box in the state park in North Providence.
It was awful. A woman and her two kids found the box. They saw a leg sticking out and thought it was a store mannequin, but upon closer inspection, the mother realized that the box contained the remains of a pot-bellied, balding old man. And when the police arrived, they didn't even need to fingerprint the body. They knew on sight that it was the 82-year-old Mike Ross.
The Austrian-born jeweler's reputation as a purveyor of hot items wasn't limited to Rhode Island and went back to the early 1940s. The things he moved included gold, precious gems, and even stock certificates. The man with piles of cash always on hand had connections with legit jewelers as well as those not so above board, but somehow, over the decades, he managed to avoid any real jail time, although he was certainly known to law enforcement. The IRS and the New England Strike Force Against Organized Crime charged him with unpaid taxes for the time period between 1966 and 1970, totaling $170,000. But he escaped most of the charges, and in exchange for a guilty plea on one count, he was fined $5,000 and received a one-year suspended sentence. When it came time for the bonded vault heist, Ross's name was one of those on the infamous list. Supposedly he had a fortune buried there, but we will never know.
And even in his old age, he still hustled, carrying the tools of his trade everywhere he went, including scales to weigh and chemicals to test the precious metals that he fenced. And the last day of his life was no different, except for the fact that he needed two canes to make the rounds. He stopped at Cece's place in Olneyville Square around 9 in the morning. He wasn't much of a drinker, so the proprietors of places he frequented would keep his adored pineapple juice on hand. But that day in March didn't end like the others. The man who always had wads of cash in his pockets was found with his pockets turned out and nothing but a pack of matches, two pieces of candy, one dime, and a set of dentures.
And I am so sorry for my insane dog barking in the background, but she hears our neighbors and doesn't like it. You know that the ghostwriter of Dennis Raimondi's book was an Olneyville native?
No, I did not know that, but let's save that for our Dennis Raimondi discussion.
Okay. We've already mentioned Ross had been killed by a .22 caliber Winchester 190 rifle, and poor Ross was shot at close range, tearing apart his heart, liver, and lungs. Two of the 10 rounds went straight through him. The medical examiner said that it was likely that he was seated and the shooter was standing.
And can you imagine that just 4 days earlier, the rifle was sitting in the Warwick police station?
They admitted it was a mistake that they returned it to David Arthur Rourke.
Hey, some mistake. And to add more irony to the story, an 18-year-old Rourke had become Ross's constant companion over the previous couple of years.
And talk about an odd couple. The old 5'4" Ross, decked out in his suit, chomping on a cigar, and the 6'2", 200-pound blonde-haired Hulk, also in a suit with a cigar in his mouth, parading around together.
You have to assume Ross was using Rourke as muscle, especially after the bonded vault heist. He must have felt he had a target on his back.
I also think Ross must have felt bad for the kid. Rourke started hanging around in the Wedgwood Tavern with his father, who was an iron worker. According to the owner of the Wedgwood, Rourke would always come in hoping Ross was there, but the feeling wasn't mutual. But as Ross started to have cognitive issues, Rourke started driving Ross around and became his mini-me. Ross's son could never figure out the connection. When he asked his father why Rourke, Ross told his son that he was a good thief.
It was also rumored that Ross was using Rourke's mother's house for his business dealings while she was at work. And let's face facts, besides hanging in the tavern, Rourke was in and out of court from the age of 15 for forged checks, stealing cars, reckless driving, burglary, and so on. The family shipped him off to California, where he tried to join the Air Force, but was bounced after 39 days for quote-unquote medical reasons.
Medical reasons, more like psych reasons.
Hey, that's medical.
Well, his medical issue landed him back in Rhode Island with a rap sheet that included some 20 charges by then, and that's when he became Ross's protege, in his mind at least, hanging around the Teramo Social Club telling stories, including a claim that he was Crazy Joe Gallo's bodyguard.
He was just 14 when Gallo got killed.
I suspect that meth wasn't his strong suit.
One Rhode Island statey said that from the stories he told, he would have to be 100 years old.
And his stories weren't making any friends for him. Many thought he was an informant, and indeed he was, but none of the information he fed to the cops was actually of any value. For the most part, they thought he was harmless, which brings us to the Winchester.
Right. So 5 months earlier, Rourke and his brother were out in the woods at 1:30 in the morning shooting cans of beans. Van Camp's pork and beans, to be exact.
My God, you are not old enough to remember the pork and beans situation, but they used to come in these dark glass, like little potbelly jars, and you would see this big hunk of like gelatinous pork fat sort of smushed to the side in there with the beans. It was gross.
I'm telling you, we need a virtual mob food tour, but I don't know where Van Camp's would fit into that. Well, but anyway, back to the woods now. So someone called the cops to say they heard shots being fired. When they arrived, they found the Rourke brothers shooting the beans and confiscated the weapons. On March 24th, Rourke called up Captain Benson of the Warwick PD, who also happened to be his neighbor, and asked if he could get the two rifles back. Rourke told Benson that he wanted to sell them and finance a return trip to California.
According to the authorities, Benson thought the charges against David Rourke were just misdemeanors and that only his brother Patrick was facing felony charges, so he mistakenly released the rifle to an 18-year-old with 20 arrests who obviously wasn't packing a full deck.
I don't buy the mistaken part for a minute.
Likewise.
So Rourke picked them up that afternoon and hid them at his house because his mother didn't want the weapons there. The following day, he took them to the Cranston Gun and Coin Shop where he originally purchased them and sold them back for $25. Then the next day, he went back and repurchased them along with 100 rounds of ammo.
And Mike Ross was in the car waiting for him.
You can't make this stuff up. And Ross must have given up the money to purchase.
Right, and who knows what story he told to Ross why the guns were actually there. I doubt he told him that he sold them to them the day before. The following day, Sunday, March 27th, Ross showed up at the Rourke house tooting his horn, according to Rourke's sister. She also informed the authorities that her brother told her several days before that if Ross showed up, to tell him he wasn't home. Other witnesses in the neighborhood corroborated the story that they sat in the car for 2 hours that day. The owner of CC's later told the police that Ross told him that he had lent Rourke a substantial amount of money which he had not paid back.
And that brings us back to Ross's final day. He told his wife that he was headed to the Dunkin' Donuts at the Four Corners in Warwick to meet Rourke. In addition to his two canes, he was wearing a leather money belt that he frequently donned. The money belt was said to have contained $10,000 that day, but neither the belt nor the money were ever recovered.
Money belts are another nostalgia thing for me. Anyhow, in true psychopath fashion, Rourke began phoning Pearl Ross, Mike's wife, around 1 in the afternoon.
4 times, no less.
Can you imagine? He told her that Ross never showed up for their meeting and that someone had taken Ross for a ride. He said he was going to put a crew together and go looking for him. Then at 9 p.m., Rourke phoned Mrs. Ross to tell her Ross was dead. Distraught, she called the police, who issued a missing persons report at 2:35 in the morning on the 29th, and that effing nut proceeded to call Benson, the cop, to tell him that Ross had been hit by the boys. Benson ignored it until the mother and her two kids happened upon Ross's body in the Lazy Boy box in the park.
He was such a nice boy.
Yeah.
In the meantime, Rourke was on the run, and his mother was in a panic because she found blood on a wicker chair in their sitting room, which she claimed was a family heirloom.
How is it a family heirloom? It was wicker in Warwick. It's not like it was a Chippendale or a Wright.
I knew that would get your veins of your blue blood boiling.
No, thank you so much. Rourke told everyone that the blood was from their dead, pregnant calico cat that he had to bury.
Wait, he killed the cat to cover his tracks?
It appears so. Mrs. Rourke authorized a search of the home, where in addition to the bloody wicker chair and bloody carpet, they recovered a .22 caliber slug like the one that would be used in the Winchester. Some 12 hours later, Rourke strolled into the Warwick PD and surrendered.
He was held in PC at the ACI since he was in fear for his life. In the 14 months he was waiting trial, he had plenty of time to concoct more stories, including that an attorney had hired him to kill Ross for $1,000. In another tale, he said he witnessed two underworld figures leaving his home the day Ross was killed there.
He fingered Dennis Raimondi, who would be killed just 4 days after Ross, and who is the next person we'll be discussing?
Well, let's wrap this one up first.
All right, go ahead.
Rourke pleaded no contest on the charges of second-degree murder and robbery. He was subsequently sentenced to 20 years. Then, in June of 81, he went on hunger strike to protest an attempt to transfer him to the maximum security section. And since he had to have drama, he gave a state senator $1,000 to help get pro-learner pardoned. Then there was the scandal of with Rourke going on furlough and disappearing.
I wonder what Pro thought about all of that. And you know Rourke had to be a fanboy of Pro's.
Hey, who wasn't a fanboy of Pro learners?
All of them in the ACI clamoring to go hang out with him and his juicer.
No doubt. In 1984, his sentence was reduced to 15 years plus 5 years suspended with 5 years probation. And then in 2009, he brought a case against the state regarding his sentence for Ross's murder, mainly because he wanted to be buried in a veteran cemetery upon passing. He said he was disqualified because of his conviction, never mentioning the Army bounced him after 39 days. I think he's still kicking and writing letters to the editors of the Providence Journal on veterans' rights.
Heaven help us all. Now it's Denny Litwin's time at last, or as most know him, Dennis Danny Raimondi. He was about as Italian as I am.
I'm more Italian than he is. Both of his parents came from where your paternal grandparents came from.
And you're actually like an eighth Italian. But anyhow, there never has
still
been
more than Danny Raimondi.
Well, this is true. And there never have been and still aren't any Italians in the place where his parents were from. There's Poles, Ukrainians, Jews, an occasional Mennonite, and German, but zero Italians.
Exactly. And as we mentioned a few minutes ago, Denny Litvin was killed on April 1st, just 4 days after Mike Ross. He had been shot multiple times at his home in Bristol, Massachusetts. His body wasn't discovered until Sunday, April 3rd, though. And as we mentioned last week, we decided to put Dennis in the Rhode Island episode since he was so wrapped up with the Providence scene and Raymond Patriarca specifically.
Shall we clear up the how and why of Dennis not being a Raimondi and not being Italian?
Sure. So Dennis was born on July 19th, 1923 in New York. His father was Stepan Litvin.
Was he a Stepan or a Stefan?
Well, it's Stepan on his paperwork. He was Steve on his naturalization documents, though.
All right. So most likely he was Ukrainian, because if he was Polish, then he would have been Stefan. And I missed that when we talked about him in season one. And the Steve thing is normal because Steve is from Stefan. But anyhow, it's an old Grand Duchy of Lithuania surname. It's Lito, as in summer.
Ah, but I don't think our listeners are as obsessive over things like that.
Okay, so let's continue.
So Dennis's biological father died in 1927. By the 1940 census, Dennis was living with his mother, his stepfather, and two stepbrothers in New York City. His stepfather, Antonio Raimondi, was with the Columbos. Dennis got into boxing and fought under his stepfather's name, and that's how Dennis Litvin, the nice Ukrainian boy, became Danny Raimondi, wise guy extraordinaire.
And possibly in an effort to rewrite his own story, Dennis claimed that he and his family moved to Fall River in the 1930s, but the census records show otherwise. The ninth grade dropout was dishonorably discharged after 2.5 years in the Army for desertion and assault, and after that, he landed at his maternal uncle's house in Fall River.
Well, think of how bad you have to be kicked out of the Army during a war.
And he's not the only one of our Rhode Island boys that happened to.
Well, that is true. But Denny's first known civilian arrest was along with Harvey Bastani in May of 52. He was held on a weapons possession charge. We did a full episode on Bastani, the one-eyed former boxer who was supposedly buddies with Willie the actor Sutton, and he was also one of the men who helped put the legendary Teddy Green away.
The police claimed that Dennis had revealed that he and Bastani and another man were planning a big holdup in Providence. Dennis was freed on $10,000 bail in July of that year and given a 5-year suspension sentence in February of 53. Then a little over 2 years later, he was arrested again, this time for arson. He and an accomplice set two trucks on fire in the parking lot of the Old Colony Transportation Company. Denny pleaded innocent and bail was set at $5,000. The charges were eventually dropped. Now, I have questions about when he actually started cooperating.
Me too. And you know the authorities believed that he had done it at Raymond Patriarca's behest.
Which leaves even more questions for me.
So during an investigation into a loan scheme in late 1961, Denny was questioned about his relationship with the Patriarcas. He told the feds that he had become acquainted with the Patriarcas about 5 or 6 years prior. He claimed that the friendship had been struck when he was just hanging around at Wells Ave.
And he wasn't just hanging around at Wells Ave. His stepfather, Antonio, Tony, Anthony, whatever we want to call him, Raimondi, ran the dry cleaners that was located directly across the street from the Coin-O-Matic. And since he was also a Columbo guy, I'm sure that Anthony and Raymond were chatting about more than Dennis calling his mother.
Oh, that was on the Coin-O-Matic wiretap from October of 64. Tony Raimondi paid a visit to Raymond and proceeded to gossip about the stuff with Joe Bonanno and the situation in New York City. Along with his plea to Raymond to force Denny to call his mother twice a week and send her $10 a week, Raymond promised to make Denny call his mother and send her the money. For good measure, Raymond said he would also make sure Denny visited his mother twice a month.
I'm not sure if Denny kept his promise, but he landed in federal prison in 1971 for organizing the hijacking of $50,000 worth of dressers on January 4th earlier that year. According to the other men involved, Raimondi was the mastermind of the scheme that involved the theft of 4,000 garments going from Fall River to New York, which earned him a 4-year prison sentence.
Later that same year, he pleaded guilty to charges of conspiring to defraud the government in a tax dodge scheme that involved setting fire to the financial records of the local 57 softball team, of which he was a member. And part of his plea agreement was to tell all in court about his involvement with Raymond, including his proclamation that Raymond had made him and that Junior Patriarca had been made in the early 70s, both of which we know weren't true. In exchange for his false testimony, he was sent to a low-security federal prison in Minnesota called Sandstone to serve his time.
You have to figure the feds listened because our least favorite tale weaver, Vinnie Teresa, told the authorities that Dennis was the number 3 in command behind Raymond and Jerry Angiulo.
Yeah, didn't the authorities know that Vinnie Teresa was a liar?
Well, obviously not. Gerald McDowell from the Organized Crime Task Force told the press that he had gone to visit Raimondi in prison in 1973 and offered to place him in witness protection if he would give them more information before the statute of limitations expired. But Dennis told them no thank you. According to his own statements to the press following his release, he believed since he gave the feds nothing, he would be fine on the streets.
Well, McDowell later said he hoped the person who would do it, kill him, would walk up to him and kill him in front. He wasn't upset. He wasn't fearful.
And as for the chatter on the street, once Dennis was back in Rhode Island, one informant reported, quote, Danny Raimondi is spending a lot of time with Nick Bianco on Federal Hill. Raimondi must think that everything is forgiven the way he walks around in public and hangs around Federal Hill, end quote. Dennis wasn't just busy hanging around Federal Hill. With the help of his stepson and a loan from his sister, he opened Danny's hideaway and settled down in a house in Somerset, Mass., and that is where he would meet his end. He was shot in the chest once, 3 times in the back, and 3 times in the head with a .38 caliber revolver on the evening of April 1st. He was found by Robin Raposa on April 3rd, lying face down in the kitchen of his single-story white ranch-style home.
Well, found, that's kind of a generous thing to say. Anyway, it wasn't exactly what happened, but we'll get to that in a minute. So shortly after Raimondi's murder, an unnamed informant told his FBI handler that several people had told Denny that he was crazy to have written a book about the FBI and the mafia. The informant also alleged that Patriarca was very upset that Denny had mentioned him by name in the book on several occasions. In the same interview, the CIA also claimed that Denny owed several people money, and that might have been the reason he was killed.
And Denny was pretty upfront about the money that he owed to friends, family, and the government as restitution for the stolen dresses in the IRS cases. So that was not a secret, nor was the fact that he shouldn't have written a book exactly a revelation either.
Well, when the journos caught up with Raymond Patriarca, they asked him what he thought about Denny's murder. Raymond told them that, quote, he was a good friend, but I haven't seen him since I was out, meaning since he'd been released from prison. quote, "You better call the FBI. They were his protectors and everything," Raymond quipped.
You've got to love the Raymondisms. Just a little over 2 weeks later, on April 19th, four men were arraigned for Raimondi's murder. The Bristol County District Attorney stated that the killing was not related to the mafia at all, but that it was a dispute over money.
And as it turned out, there was a witness to the murder, the sister of one of the four men indicted. Mrs. Robin Raposa testified that she was actually present but hiding in the house when Denny was killed, and that her brother and three other men had come to Raimondi's home where they had argued over some $6,000 that Raimondi had borrowed from them. Her brother and two of the men had walked out, but Morris, I still don't know, Charest, had stayed and continued arguing with Denny. They had an altercation. Morris pulled a gun and shot Denny and then drove off.
But she ended up retracting her testimony 2 months later. The case dragged out until January the following year, when all four men were found not guilty. The judge also ruled that there was insufficient evidence to convict them.
But Mrs. Raposa wasn't as lucky as her brother. She was indicted on a perjury charge. And to be clear, she was not an angel. While she was still the unwed Miss DaCosta, she had apparently participated in the murder of a 17-year-old Fall River girl in December of 1772 when she was just 14.
Why am I not surprised by any of that? She also had some credibility issues, so to speak, when she was called as a witness in another case years later, but let's not get into that now.
Well, I think we should wrap this up since we must be roughly at 20 minutes at least, and we still have half a dozen more slayings to talk about and an international drug smuggling case.
You mean Ponytail Perlo's adventures have to wait another week?
I think so.
All right, so we will be back next week with part three of the Hit Parade of 1977. I promise that will be the last part, and I swear. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.